Now tonight we're discussing, I don't know what your page says. Does your page say lesson 10? That's what it's supposed to say. Well, good. But once you get off, it's hard to get back on, and I got off, and so I'm not sure any Wednesday night if I'm where I belong. But we are on number 10. We have 12 in this session, so two more weeks after tonight. Next week, we will be looking at prophecy, the biblical genre or form or style of material called prophecy. And then the last week, we will be looking at apocalyptic literature. But tonight, we're looking at wisdom literature. So get your pens and paper out and let's get ready to go. Again, we've talked about a number of different genres, forms, styles, whatever you want to call them. That is, kinds of literature that are found in the Bible. And we've grouped them together in six kinds or genres in the Old Testament and six genres or kinds of literature in the New Testament. There is some bleed over, some crossover, some material, some genres like gospels contain bits or pieces of other genres within them. For instance, there is in the Old Testament narrative, parable. Remember when Nathan confronted King David? He told him a parable. And the same is true in the New Testament. You will find bits, pieces of genre that don't really fall into the category. So let's just do a brief review of the kinds or the forms or the styles or the genres, whatever you want to call it, of literature that you find in the Old Testament. Just number one, just give me one. Narrative, thank you. Okay. Did you say law? Okay, law. Sorry? Poetic, very good, thank you. Poetry. Okay, history tells what has happened. There's narrative, that's narrative, very good. There is apocalyptic literature in the Old Testament. Anything else? Old Testament. Prophecy, that's right, very good. So narrative, laws, poetry, apocalyptic literature, prophecy, and then what we're studying tonight, wisdom literature. What about the New Testament? Now remember, these are not all unique. Some that are found in the Old Testament are also found in the New Testament. I'm giving you a hint. Narrative. In the New Testament, you find narrative. Apocalyptic literature. Gospels, very good. Sorry? I haven't told you that. There is a bit of wisdom in the New Testament. It's not a genre. And James is an epistle, a letter. But it, as a letter, it contains some wisdom. There's no question about that. We have gospels, letters, apocalyptic, poetry, parables, and narratives in the New Testament. So tonight we're looking at wisdom literature, and as a form or as a kind of literature, we would group it in the Old Testament because that's where most of the wisdom literature is found, is in the Old Testament. So let's talk about the wisdom literature that there is in the Bible. There are bunches, if you would. There are collections of wisdom literature in the Bible. There is wisdom literature in the book of Psalms. Psalm 1, Psalm 49, and Psalm 73 are all wisdom psalms. Now, the next four books are all incomplete, or in total, considered wisdom literature. Proverbs, the Song of Songs, or Song of Solomon. It's not two different books. Those are two different titles for the same book. Job. And Ecclesiastes. As Dr. Bracey pointed out, there are some New Testament passages as well as other Old Testament passages that form bits of wisdom literature found in other books. But the books that we've listed are complete books of wisdom literature. Now, wisdom literature is not unique to the Bible. We're going to talk about what it is in a minute, but I want to first make it clear that it doesn't simply belong to biblical literature. There's wisdom literature outside the Bible. There is wisdom literature in Egyptian, Mesopotamian, Assyrian. Many of these sources predate. They predate our Bible. We find wisdom literature in what's called, considered, it's Jewish literature, called the Old Testament Apocrypha. You will find it in the Wisdom of Solomon, Ecclesiasticus, and the Book of Baruch. Wisdom literature exists outside of the Middle East. It's found in the Analects, A-N-A-L-E-C-T-S, Analects of Confucius. And wisdom literature is found in all of the major world religions. But what is biblical wisdom literature? What is biblical wisdom? Proverbs 9, verse 10 says, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom." But that still doesn't answer the question, what is wisdom? Derek Kidner, in his commentary, dated as it is, on Proverbs, suggests that biblical wisdom is the ability to make godly choices. The ability to make godly choices. And in fact, as you read wisdom literature, you discover that it is focused on how people, successful people, in at least in terms of God's perspective, successful people make godly choices. And how they are learning to apply God's truth in their life. So, it appears that biblical wisdom literature is aimed at causing the reader or guiding the reader to successful living through godly choices. Fee and Stewart on page 228 say, "The very first step then in biblical wisdom is knowing God, not abstractly or theoretically, but in the concrete sense of committing your life to Him. Then your general direction will be correct, and as you learn specific guidelines and perspectives for making godly choices, and more precise direction for wise living, a more precise direction for wise living can follow. They conclude, wisdom, therefore, as the Bible defines it, has nothing to do with IQ. Can anybody say amen? It is not a matter of cleverness or skill in expression or age. It is a matter of orientation to God, out of which comes the ability to please Him. So I don't know if we've fully defined what biblical wisdom is, but I think we've given ourselves some parameters. Now let's talk about the types of wisdom literature that we find in the Bible. There are essentially three kinds that we find. The first is called proverbial wisdom, and as you would guess, the book of Proverbs is made up mostly of proverbial wisdom. A second kind of wisdom literature is known as speculative wisdom. Speculative wisdom is found in the book of Job and in the book of Ecclesiastes, and speculative wisdom pertains to the meaning of life and the purpose of such things as suffering, relationships between people, between people and God, between people and themselves. And then finally, we find lyric wisdom. Exactly. That's the Song of Solomon or the Song of Songs. And as one would expect by its title, lyric wisdom is very abstract. Now, when you're reading wisdom literature, here's a suggestion. Read it as if you were reading poetry, because there are many similarities between wisdom literature and poetic literature. Pay attention especially to parallelism, because parallelism is a common feature of wisdom literature, as it is with poetry. One type of parallelism that is presented frequently is synonymous parallelism that we talked about when we discussed poetry. Turn to Proverbs. Let's go to chapter 16. Chapter 16, look at verse 18. Read the first line. Don't read the second line. Read the first line. Pride goes before destruction. Now, if this is parallelism, the next line is going to be related to the first line. Let's see if it is. Pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall. Do those seem to go together? Do they seem to be parallel? In what way do they seem parallel? They both deal with the same things, don't they? They say the same thing. They use different words. This is known as synonymous parallelism. They say exactly the same thing, only with different words. Another type of parallelism is known as antithetical. Antithetical parallelism. Keep your Bible open. And for this, turn to Proverbs chapter 10. Proverbs chapter 10. Look at verse 1. Now, the question is this parallelism? That's the first question. We have parallelism here. In other words, do the first and second lines refer, or do they in any way seem to be together? Are they adjacent? Are they just there by geography, or are they there in terms of the subject matter? If they are there in terms of the subject matter, then they're parallel. So a wise son makes a glad father. What does that say? I mean, I can read it. I know what it says. What does it say? What does it mean? Not just any son. A wise son. Now, we've already talked about what is wisdom. The ability to make or the action of making godly choices. Okay? So a son who has the attributes of wisdom that is makes wise choices or godly choices, does what to his father? Makes him happy. Look at the next phrase. But a foolish son is a sorrow to his mother. Now, are those in any way parallel? What is parallel about the two of these lines? There are parents involved in both. There's a father in the first and a mother in the second. But there's one common thing. It's a son. It's a son. The son in the first is characterized by wisdom. The son in the second line is characterized by folly or foolishness. Related to in the first verse, or the first line, is the reference to the father. Related in the second line is the reference to the mother. So they're parallel, but they're not synonymous. In fact, they're opposite. They're antithetical. They say exactly the opposite things about the same subject. Look at chapter 11. Chapter 11, verse 1. A false balance is an abomination to the Lord. What does that say? What is it about? It's about dishonesty, isn't it? We know it's about thievery and dishonesty. It talks about a false balance. And how does God view it? It's hateful to God. It's hateful to Him. Second line. But a just weight is His delight. Now, both lines are about one thing. They're about weighing, about scales. That's right. Both lines are about scales. The first line is about a false scale, and God's disposition toward it is hateful or an abomination. In the second line, it's about a scale, but in this case, it is an appropriate or right scale, where an ounce is an ounce. And how is that scale viewed by God? Not hateful to Him at all. It is His joy. It is His delight. Now, understand something. Those are about the same thing. Therefore, they're parallel. But they say exactly the opposite. So they are antithetically parallel. Look at chapter 12, verse 1. Whoever loves discipline loves knowledge. What's that about? What does that say? Whoever loves discipline loves knowledge. What's it about? What is the subject? It's about discipline. It's about discipline. The person who loves discipline. That's what this is about. The person who loves discipline loves knowledge. What's he saying? What's he saying? The two are together. These two things go together. Discipline and knowledge. So the person who loves discipline loves knowledge. They go together. Look at the next verse, or the next line. But he who hates reproof, I can't say this in the church, even if it's in the Bible, because I can say hell on Sunday morning and I get no letters, but if I say stupid, every parent in the building writes me an email. My children were here. I know, I get it. But they're your children, so you deal with it. But he who hates reproof is stupid. Stupid. What's it about? What's that line about? It's not about stupid. It's not about hating. It's about reproof. Now, discipline and reproof are synonymous. They mean the same things. Two different words for the same thing. So these are parallel lines. They talk about the same thing. Discipline, reproof. You could invert the words. You could replace the words with another synonym. But they don't say the same things about discipline or reproof. They have something to say about a person and their disposition toward discipline and reproof. A person who loves discipline loves knowledge. And the point is, they are one in the same. Discipline and knowledge are one in the same. Or another way of saying it is, with discipline comes knowledge. Discipline is the vehicle. Knowledge is the content. On the other hand, antithetically, or opposite of that, a person who hates reproof. What's reproof? Discipline. It's stupid. I mean, that cuts to the chase, doesn't it? No flowery words. They don't hate knowledge. They're already stupid. A third kind of parallelism that you will find in wisdom literature is known as synthetic parallelism. That is where one line builds, or the second line builds on what is stated in the previous line. I don't know if I've said that right or not. Wednesdays are long, folks. I know they're no longer than they ever have been. My mind is shorter than it used to be. How about that? So I'm not always clear. I know what I mean. It just doesn't always come out. What I'm trying to say is synthetic parallelism, the second line takes the thought of the first line and expands on it. You'll find a case of synthetic parallelism in Proverbs chapter 11, since we're already in that area. Look at verse 22. Like a gold ring in a pig's snout is a beautiful woman without discretion. Now, the second line expands the thought of the first line. The first line is clearly to create a visual image. It did too, didn't it? And you don't even live around pigs, I don't think. And even if you live around pigs, you don't live around any pigs with gold rings in their noses. Neither did anyone in Solomon's day. Because gold rings don't belong in pigs' noses. They're out of place. They're completely out of place, and that's the intention. So what he does is he draws this stark image for the reader in this picture. A pig with a gold ring in its snout. What does all that mean? Why in the world would you make me think of such a thing? Because with that in mind, hear what I have to say. A beautiful woman without discretion. Wow. Now, I'm not picking on women, beautiful or otherwise, and you be the judge. Of either gender, we would go on and say, if we were applying this, but such is the wisdom of biblical wisdom. It gets to the root of the human condition, because it is not merely a trait or a trend that a beautiful woman is idolized now. It has always been that way. Beautiful women are exalted, idolized, almost worshipped, without consideration of their comparison in some cases. A beautiful woman who lacks discretion is like a gold ring in an unseemly location. Now, how is it like that? How is it like that? What is the comparison? Say that again. So the gold ring ruins the pig? No? I mean, we can elaborate and do a good... If I was preaching this, and Lord knows I won't, but if I was preaching this, can you see the elbowing that would go on? And I don't mean just in the youth section. I'm talking about all over the building. We can elaborate. All of us can elaborate. And the reason is this wisdom is universal. Take that anywhere. Read this anywhere. And even if it's not acknowledged, it's understood. Turn to chapter 12. That is synthetic, yes. The initial thought, that is what's given in the first line, is built in the second line. Chapter 12, verse 14. From the fruit of his mouth, a man is satisfied with good, and the work of a man's hand comes back to him. From the fruit of his mouth, a man is satisfied with good, and the work of a man's hand comes back to him. What is it saying in the first line? From the fruit of his mouth, a man is satisfied with good. What is the fruit of a person's mouth? What? Say it again. Somebody? No, it's not wisdom, necessarily. Wise words. Truth. Virtuous things. Speak good, true, virtuous things. Guess what you get? Look, people know a good person. It doesn't mean they won't take advantage or try to take advantage of a good person, but they know a good person. They know a good person because what that person says is good. It's true. It's fair. It's just. It's kind. Loving, perhaps. And if that's what this person is engaging in, then that's what this person is doing. It's the environment this person is building by their words and obviously by their deeds. And the second line elaborates on that. The work of a man's hand comes back to him. And the image there is a construction image. This man is building with integrity. Character. But if it was a construction, he's building plumb walls, level foundation, and upon completion, he's given the keys to live in the house he's just built. That's the image that's offered. Look at chapter 15. Verse 23, to make an apt answer is a joy to a man. Let's just use this room as an example of this. When I ask a question and answers come pouring out, I'm listening for an answer, so I can grab it and go with it. I'm looking for the right answer. Or at least, in my judgment, the right answer. Now, that's an image. That's not the best image. The image that's being drawn here is a man asking a question and wanting a particular answer. He wants a particular answer. Can I have a raise? May I have your daughter's hand in marriage? A man who asks those questions desires a particular answer, doesn't he? What happens when he gets the right answer? The answer he wants. What happens? Of course he's happy. I mean, if you didn't want it, you shouldn't have asked for it. Look at the second line. And a word in season. A word in season. How good it is. How good it is. So you have this picture presented in the first line that really doesn't make any sense. I mean, you can't argue with it. The guy's going to be happy when he gets the answer he wants. What does that mean? Well, a word at the right time, the right word at the right time, is a good thing. It's a good thing. And I've got to tell you something. We all understand this. Everybody in this room is old enough to understand there are times you're just speechless. There are times you're just speechless. The moment is so overwhelming or so incomprehensible that no word comes to mind. And when someone speaks and suggests the right thing at that moment, there's no getting away from it. That makes all the difference in the world. It doesn't matter what religion you are. It doesn't matter where in the world you are. That is wisdom. There is a right season. Know what it is. there is a right word in that season. Use it. Look at verse 24. Same chapter, same line. Look at the next verse. The path of life leads upward for the prudent. The path of life leads up for the prudent. Now, this is also synthetic parallelism. What's stated in the first line is expanded or elaborated on in the second line. The path of life leads upward for the prudent. Upward? I mean upstairs? Does that mean onto the roof? What are we talking about here? We're talking about the path of life, but not just any path of life, the path of life that is followed by whom? The prudent. Right. We'd call it the wise man. The path of life. In other words, the course, the journey of a person who is wise leads upward. Now, that doesn't make a lot of sense. I mean, we could draw all kinds of conclusions. I'd really like him to elaborate. What are you talking about? And he does. He elaborates in the next line. That he may turn away from Sheol beneath. So what's he talking about? He's making an assertion about the life of a wise person. What's that assertion? It leads upward. Upward relative to where? Well, I don't know until I read the next line. Death. Death. Now, this is not a reference to Hades or Gehenna or the lake of fire, Sheol. It just means death. Death. David said, if I go down into Sheol, he's with me there. In other words, a wise life leads up out of death. It leads up out of and away from death. Now, the picture here is a brilliant picture. But it's one we easily miss because of all of our theological baggage that we have relative to heaven and hell and the Christian perspective that heaven and hell are both terminus and eternal beyond us. We don't always look at, well, heaven already exists. You do understand that. And hell already exists. You do understand that too, don't you? Think in terms then, if that's difficult to navigate, just think in terms of this. You're either alive or you're dead. There's no sort of dead. Right? He's sort of dead. On Sunday morning, I doubt that. It might be sort of dead. But there's no sort of dead. There's either dead or there's alive. But you have a general direction relative to death. And some paths are headed straight there. I think it was AC/DC. I don't know the guy's name. They've had two lead singers. The guitarist is named Angus. But they entitled a song called Highway to Hell. And they ravaged a great sound. I mean, it's a great song. If you like rock and roll, there's none better. And I do. There's also a pretty good theology in it. Because I know a little bit about AC/DC, and they were on a highway to hell. Oddly enough, they're all still alive. None of them have committed suicide. None of them have died of drug overdoses. But that does not mean they are not and were not on a highway to hell. Their lives were dying. Number six, I think I have down there, poetic literary devices. Do I have that on there? I'm not going to give those to you. You can look over in your poetry notes. because they're all there. Metaphor, simile, alliteration, assonance, acrostics, hyperbole, numerical sequences. They're all there. By the way, I don't know that I mentioned this, but did you know that Proverbs 31, the passage about the virtuous woman, remember that passage, an excellent wife? Each one of those lines begins with the letter of the Hebrew alphabet in successive order. I don't think I mentioned that last week when we were talking about poetry, but that's within Proverbs. So Proverbs use poetic devices. Now, how do we interpret these? I want to race through and interpret, tell you in 5 minutes how to interpret all of the wisdom literature in the Bible. First of all, Proverbs. Proverbs are descriptions by comparison. They are descriptions by comparison. I'm not a Hebrew scholar nor a Hebrew vocalist. I can't say the words, but I think the word for Proverbs is masal. And a masal is a significant truth expressed in few words with deep impact. Wouldn't you love a preacher who could do that? Sorry. Significant truth expressed in a few words with deep impact. Okay, how do you read Proverbs? Keep these things in mind as you read them. They are meant to be memorable. They are meant to be memorable, not theoretically accurate. They are aphorisms. Aphorisms, A-P-H-O-R-I-S-M, aphorism. They are aphorisms. They are not absolute truth. An aphorism is merely a pithy observation that contains a general truth. And because, I'm just telling you things to keep in mind as you read them. And because they are general truth, they don't contain all of the truth about any subject. I'm not going to compare our newspaper to Proverbs. Because I'll read a proverb a day, but I won't read one of our newspapers here every day. Which is why I canceled my subscription. Proverbs are not legal guarantees from God. Don't read them like that. Okay, let's read the book of Job. Let's interpret and read the book of Job. Have you read it? Well, when you read the book of Job, read it all. That's how it's meant to be handled, all at once. The book of Job is a refutation. It is disputing and defeating a worldview. The book of Job is a refutation. Refutation. Yes, a refutation of cause and effect theology. It is refuting the theology of cause and effect. By the way, that theology is an ever-popular theology. A lot of theology I see on TV and hear on TV is cause and effect theology. Well, it has to do with, if I do this, if I behave in such a way, if I believe in such a way, this will result. And there is some cause-effect theology. Make no mistake about it. Some of the covenants were cause-effect covenants. But not everything and life itself as a worldview is not cause-effect. So another way of saying this is the book of Job was written to defeat the idea that good things happen to good people and bad things happen to bad people. On page 241 in Fee and Stewart, I thought this was a great observation. If one does not pay attention to who is speaking at any given point, you will find here all sorts of wrong advice and incorrect conclusions, especially as they come from the lips of Job's comforters. This dialogue has a very important goal, to establish convincingly in the mind of the reader that what happens in life does not always happen either because God desires it or it is fair. The foil for this truth is to be found primarily in the comforters. They regularly present the viewpoint that God is not simply involved in the daily affairs of life, but that he is in fact constantly meting out his judgment through the events of life. Why did this happen? Why did this happen? And so many times we ask that question sincerely without recognizing that what we're doing is we are promulgating, promoting a cause-effect theology. Why did this happen? Well, let's get to the original cause, okay? And the original effect. The original cause is sin. And the original effect is death. And that cause and effect permeates this world so that it is both unfortunate and misguided to ever ask that question again. And yet we do. Ecclesiastes. Let's interpret Ecclesiastes. Two basic approaches that are offered to interpreting Ecclesiastes. One is the secular view, one is the spiritual view. Ecclesiastes is an expression of cynical wisdom. It is an expression of cynical wisdom. And that cynical wisdom serves as a foil, a defeater, if you would, of an outlook in life that suggests meaning can be found in this world. Meaning can be found outside of oneself. Now, that's the secular view. And I'm going to tell you something. I use a secular view in interpreting Ecclesiastes. But I don't use a secular view in interpreting Ecclesiastes exclusively. And I handle Ecclesiastes in much the same way I handle Song of Songs. There is a spiritual view that can guide interpretation of Ecclesiastes. And it views Ecclesiastes as an expression of how one should enjoy life under God in a world in which all die in the end. See, there's a degree of cynicism in both. The spiritual view does not remove the cynical eye. The cynical eye remains. Need I remind you? Lazarus, who Jesus raised from the dead, died again. And the reality is, the original cause and effect, the original cause and effect will result, if we forget it, it will result in us asking all kinds of questions about the meaning of life that we can't answer from our experiences in this world. Because our experiences in this world will all reflect what? The original cause and effect. The tone of Ecclesiastes is negative, cynical, depressed, bitter, pessimistic. My kind of book. And because that's the tone, I think that a secular view in terms of interpreting Ecclesiastes is appropriate for it. And from that secular view, you find a defense of a life of faith in comparison to the grimness of a life without faith. I doubt it. It defends a life of faith by showing the grimness of a life without faith. That's the secular view. The spiritual view, Fee and Stewart write, even if the only real certainty about this present life is the certainty of the grave, one should still live life, fleeting as it is, as a gift from God. Now that's the secular view. You see, the secular view and the spiritual view are not so different. Now, the Song of Songs, and I hate to go over time, but I have to finish this or we'll never finish in the time period that we need to. The Song of Songs, there are three approaches to reading the Song of Songs. They are celebratory, a celebratory interpretation. That's just reading the book at its face value. It's a love song about romantic love between a man and a woman. It's a consummated marriage, and in that there is celebration and joy, a joy that God has given men and women in marital love. It really shows the wisdom of monogamous, heterosexual love. I have no problem reading the Song of Solomon in a celebratory way. Preaching it, I have a little more difficulty. Now, another type of interpretation approach is an allegorical interpretation of Song of Songs. Allegory means, it's two Greek words together, and it means another or other proclamation. The idea is there's meaning below the surface. There's something underneath it. Like a fable. Okay? It's an extended metaphor. And so when reading allegorically, the Song of Songs is read as if the characters point, each one of the characters point to some other meaning, like Israel or God. Or reading it through the lens of Christianity, through Christ and the church. I don't put much stock in an allegorical type of approach to anything, but particularly not to this book, because, well, we're too distant from it to be able to claim that we can recapture the allegory, for one thing, and the result is a manifold number of interpretations and conclusions. Another kind of approach is called the typological, a typological interpretation. Because what a typological, T-Y-P-O-L-O-G-I-C-A-L, typological, where allegory on the one hand kind of denies or ignores, if you would, the historicity or the factualness of the Old Testament account, and it kind of imposes like a deeper, hidden, or spiritual meaning on the text. Typology, on the other hand, recognizes the validity of the Old Testament account in its own right. But it then finds in that account a clear parallel link with some event or teaching in the New Testament, which the Old Testament account foreshadows. We have in the church library a series of commentaries called the Tyndale Old Testament Commentary. And the Tyndale Old Testament Commentary on Song of Songs follows the typological methodology of interpretation for this book. It's written by Lloyd Carr. And while we have to be careful with any kind of typological interpretation, and I want to say there is typology in the Bible, not everything in the Bible is typological, and I don't think Song of Solomon was written to be interpreted typologically, but there is typological application. So in the clearest sense, I think the celebratory interpretation is the normal interpretation of the Song of Solomon. It comes to us in three voices. It has an ethical content. It's a love song. When you read it, you do not recognize that you are being advised, but you are. Because as you read it, you feel like you're merely reading a description of something or someone, when in fact, it is suggesting by means of description. And don't forget, we do not share in exactly the same values this writer shared, that by this writer I mean Solomon. We don't share his values completely. Let's pray.